I like to say that I had to tone down my Brazilian about 75% because they can't see me. So my hands are moving, but I'm like, blah, 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 blah. People are like, oh my God, she is pissed, you know? And I'm like, I'm just trying to describe my lunch.
What's going on, guys? It's Anand here, and welcome back to the Journey Onwards podcast. If you are tuning in for the first time, in season two, I get the fortune of exploring how my guests' extraordinary backstories and their journey across borders and cultures have not only served as pivotal moments in defining their character, but also really influenced their purpose and life ambitions. Michelle Fox is a Brazilian native, a country that I have very fond memories of, and she is leading the charge of a food revolution. As a slow food chef and minority farmer advocate, she is dedicated to shining the spotlight on seasonal nutrition and food regeneration practices. And something she said that really stood out to me, she says, until all of us, including chefs, farmers, the food and beverage industry, and government, decide to take these practices seriously, we are leading to the decay of civilization. And during our insightful conversation, which was also highly entertaining, Michelle shares just how she went from being a young girl who rebelled against the gender biases in Brazil to bringing skateboarding to the local favelas before working through periods of isolation and adjustment in her early years in the US to really flourish in both the food and cannabis space and now being able to fulfill her passion for African food and culture through her role at Food Bay TV. And with all of that and your pupils dilated as always, it's now time for you to enjoy the journey. Michelle, thank you so much for being here today. I'm actually genuinely very excited to dive into this conversation for a number of reasons. Firstly, you were born and grew up in Brazil,
yep,
which is a place that I have been. And I know briefly about the history of the immigration that happened from there, but really, it's very surface level what I know. So I'm so excited to hear it from a first-hand perspective. On top of the initiatives that you're working on now, which are closely linked to Africa, which is actually where my parents are from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I have a personal connection to that side as well. So that I'm very, very excited for. And before we do dive into that, what I would love to know is a bit more about where it all began. So I'd love to hear about your childhood and growing up in Brazil.
Yeah, hi, Anand. I'm excited to be here. So I grew up in Curitiba. Curitiba is a very south part of Brazil. If you think of Argentina, that it's kind of like our cousins right there. We have Paraguay is right next to the border. The Germans, you know, the south of Brazil is the coldest part, right? Mm. So the Germans and the Italians, and they all kind of became a part of the bottom of Brazil. Like if you look at the coast of Brazil, right, you have all those coastal towns is where the slaves came in at first and everybody else, right? So you have the top of Brazil is extremely, it's like a mini Africa up there. And then the middle, you have a lot of Chinese, Japanese, and then at the very bottom, you got, you know, the Germans. And so I'm like German, Portuguese, Italian, got a little African in there. Wow. And some Brazilian Indian, I think. So it's,
do you think that mixture that you have has kind of given you the inclination to, you know, without skipping too far ahead, given you that inclination to have this more global mindset and this interest in, you know, all these kind of international endeavors that you're doing?
You know, that is something that is on my DNA. You know, and we won't skip ahead too far, but I've been learning Bob Marley songs, translating them since I was 7 years old. You know, so it's something that was just like, oh, I have to learn English. That's just what it is. And so I was always looking outside of Brazil in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I wanted to tell you a story. So, you know, I grew up in Brazil, and then so it's a very, for lack of a better word, chauvinistic times, you know. I was born in 79, so it's a long time ago. So, you know, I grew up with my mother passed away when I was four. And so I grew up with my maternal grandmother and grandfather. And so they're even a generation behind that, you know. So like my boy cousin could put his feet up after dinner. But we, the girls, had to like get up and clean the table right away because, you know, that's what women do. Wow. And like I'd been sent to typing school and cooking school, which is the beginning of my culinary journey, crochet and all these things. Like, this is how you iron a men's shirt. She was giving me the skills to become a wife. So I was a rebellious person from, you know, without a mother and all that. I was a very rebellious kid. So at the age of 15, I started skateboarding, or 14, I started skateboarding, and that became my tribe, my people. We, you know, a group of probably 15, 20 of us are the first girl skateboarding in Brazil ever. And so it was like a whole new thing. And so it was all about like, you know, F the system, like we can do whatever we want, you know? So yeah, I've been that way ever since I can remember.
And what do you think led you to have that kind of approach? Was it that you felt the system was set up wrong, or was it more that there was something in you that just wanted to have this inherent rebelliousness?
I'm a very practical person. So if you tell me the sky tomorrow will be purple, and it will be purple because of this and this and this reason, and you convince me, I will believe you with all my heart, right? But the whole idea that because you have a specific genitalia or another, that you are not allowed to do this or you're allowed to do that. Mm. It was never convinced and indented in my mind enough where I was like, okay, I'll conform. You know, it was more like, no, you're not convincing me. So I'm going to go find the people that also believes the same. And that's how I found my tribe, skateboarding, punk rock, and, you know, the misfits of society and all that. So
it is interesting, a very interesting point that you mentioned, because one thing I heard that for a lot of, especially Brazilians who left and went to the US, one of the most common things that they found almost difficult to adapt to or quite surprising was how in the US there was this thing of almost an equality between males and females, where in Brazil it was still quite, say we say, traditional, where, you know, the woman would either not work or work with just a contributory supplementary income.
Right.
Was it that on the whole, kind of in the Brazilian society, the women just accepted that this is how it was, and, you know, they didn't really ever try and question it or, like, you know, rebel against it?
I think that, you know, from the mid 80s to now, everything, a lot has changed. I think that we're coming, you know, if you talk to a 75-year-old white American, he's going to have certain ideas about what his wife should be doing, right? So I think it's more a generational thing. Mm. Plus being Brazilian, like, for example, you know, my name is Michelle, right? And I added my name is actually Michelle. Now I added the extra E when I moved to America because people will call me Michelle. And in Brazil, Michelle, like in Brazil and Italy and France, Michelle is the guy name, you know? And like in America, you can call a Billy and a Billy, and that's okay. That's acceptable. In Brazil, there is no female names are female names, male names are male names. Like, you know, back in, again, I'm talking 30 years ago, right? You know, nurses were nurses, and truck drivers are males, and nurses are females. You never find, and probably as of today, you probably very rarely will find a male kindergarten teacher. You'll find a male university teacher, maybe high school teacher. And it's kind of the same here, right? If you think about it, it's a very, I don't know if you have children, I got two. So it's a very rare thing to see a male in a young, early childhood, you know. I'm not all the way gung-ho, right? Like my husband, for example, is a very manly man. He can do anything with any tool. And, you know, and I love that. I think it's great for my personal life. I enjoy the idea that each in a relationship have, you know, what they're good at and what they're not good at, you know, and if we can put the two together, that's a great team. And sometimes the male is good at making appointments and organizing trips. And then the woman is better at, you know, truck driving. That is totally common. You know, it's just in my life, it has become where I came back into the farm and with my husband, and I have a very pretty common life compared to my teenager years, I have to say.
Yeah. And like you say, it is kind of, you still see it everywhere. It's not completely, say, eradicated. But would you say, I don't know when was the last time you went back to Brazil, but do you think it's still very apparent there?
I was, I think, 2019, looking at pictures over here. I think it was, yeah, so 2018 is when we all came back. I don't know, because, you know, I come back, I try to go back every year, but since COVID, obviously, I haven't been. But my experience in Brazil, which is about a month, is majority of the time how long I stay. It's a very catered experience, right? Like, I get to go from one family member to a friend's house, to the beach house, and then we go blah, blah. Like, everything is kind of planned. So I don't get to be inside of the household of people that I don't really necessarily know as much. But yeah, I think it's still there. It's going down now, but it has always been notoriously a Catholic country. I was born and raised Catholic. I am not a Catholic practicing person, but I was born and raised Catholic, which, you know, religion kind of locks in into that whole story of, you know, who's in charge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's still there, but I think that the new generation is kind of taking over the old generation and recreating their, you know, their values and systems and all that. Thank God.
Yeah. Interesting. And so you said you essentially were raised by your grandparents?
Yes. Grandmother and grandfather, my mother's mother. Yeah.
And what was that? What was that life like?
Like I said, a part of it, right? Like learning how to do all the chores, because otherwise I would never find a husband. But also, she was extremely knowledgeable. I used to think, like, how can she be a Catholic and a witch at the same time? You know, and it's seriously, I'll give you an example. So she would, if we had a fever, and you can test that next time you see someone with a fever. If I had a fever, she will get 2-3 egg whites, beat them up, put it on a towel, and put it on my left foot. I don't know why it had to be the left. I haven't figured that one out. But put it on my left foot, and in about 20-30 minutes, my fever was gone. It wouldn't stay gone. It wasn't fixing what was giving the fever, but it was lowering the fever. So, and I used to think that was, you know, magic, really. I'm like, how and why, you know? And so later on in, you know, in my culinary career, found out that the temperature needed to cook egg whites is extremely low. So literally the fever's cooking the eggs, you know? So she had, and this is one example of thousands, you know, like I couldn't brush my hair outside because the birds will pick up my hair and make nests with it, which then will give me headaches.
Wow.
You know, yeah. So she had all, and so I grew up with that tail, and that's why, you know, I call myself a generational herbalist, is because I learned from her, that learned from her grandmother, and then I stayed on my journey as a herbalist also in my life. But yeah, it was fun. And, you know, I hate to bring another tragedy, but my grandfather, so then my mother died of a car accident when I was 4. And then, so then my grandfather got ran over by a car when I was 11. Oh. Yeah. So my grandmother was, you know, and my aunt also, which is my mother's sister, they kind of started juggling me back and forth. So I was being raised by a lot of grief in a way, because my mother wasn't there anymore, and my grandfather. So I think it has made me kind of be a person that is always looking at the other's feelings. Like, I'm always concerned about my friends and my family. You know, I was the little kid that was like making you feel better, right? So that's kind of has been my role. You know, actually, by the way, this is the first time I ever thought of this way. That's the carer, you know, is who I am in a way. And I think that comes steam from, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old.
It'll be interesting to see how much that has influenced your kind of current intentions and motivations and purpose around wanting to help and give back. And again, I don't want to give too many spoilers for the rest of the story, but it seems that there's such a strong link between you realizing this is how you were growing up and kind of how it's influenced or shaped what you're kind of striving to do now through what you're doing. So that's fascinating. But before we get into all that, so what was schooling like?
So we went to private school the entire time. Public school is extremely difficult in Brazil. My family, you know, my aunt and uncle started out of nothing, and they're extremely brilliant business people. So we had a good life. So we went to private Catholic school, lots of rules and everything, you know, and I was not really into school. It was boring to me. But English was my favorite subject because we learned English in school, I think from fifth grade on. So on fifth grade was the first time. And before that, you know, I have memories of watching, and, you know, I can't quote an exact movie, but I remember watching, you know, the Bay Bridge and watching New York and being like as a little kid and being, someday I'm going to be there, you know, and I lived in San Francisco 5 years. And so, and I was, you know, listening to English and we were reading the subtitles, you know, at that time I couldn't read yet. But then by fifth grade, that's when I started learning English at school, but also Bob Marley. I was like a huge fan of Bob Marley from very young, like 7, 8 years old. And so I found a tape somewhere. I think my uncle had one. And so I would sit and listen, pause and listen, like pretty much word by word, and try to write it down then try to go to my, you know, to then translate on my little, you know, translating book. And it's funny because there's songs, they're Bob Marley songs that I sing, and other songs, by the way, I'm actually famous for it. There's other songs that, you know, I sing with, because I'm also a singer, I love to sing. So I sing with words that are not the correct word, but I just been singing those for 30 yeah. years that way, and I refuse to change it, you know? So, yeah.
That does happen. There's these certain songs that you like, you don't know why, maybe something about the rhythm, the time you heard it, and whatever you remember the words being, if someone then goes to try and tell you, actually, it's something else, even if you try it, your mind will, at the back of your mind, you will always say those words that you know.
You're trained.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're trained for it. So it's just, that's amazing. It is what it is. Yeah.
So it seemed like you had this fascination that came about for the US and
the world, I think.
Okay. Yeah. And so from that point, did you always know that in one way or another, you were going to move to the US or somewhere?
I knew I was going to move somewhere. I also at very early age understood that English was the language of the world.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I wanted to travel. And so to travel by speaking English, I was able to, you know, to speak to pretty much anyone around the world. So that's something that I think I don't know if I should say this by now, but by the time I turned 16 and a half, I became a foreign exchange student in the United States. So I did my senior year in Chatham, Alabama. I think it's like 1,000 population. And so, but very different experience than I imagine, to tell you the truth. You know, a 16-year-old punk Brazilian skater in a very small southern town in the United States. I mean, we didn't necessarily get along very well. So the experience is very crazy. I mean, I had, you know, I at age 16 had to call the people from the exchange student program to my school because my principal was telling me I was going to have to leave the school if I didn't pledge religion to the flag of the United States.
Wow.
Out loud. And I told him, like, I can stand, but I won't. I can't pledge religion to your flag. If you put the Brazilian flag there, I will.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and he was like, well, if you don't do that, you can't go back to class. So so I left the United States with a bitter taste in my mouth. I used to say, I will never, you know, and I believe that once you say, I will never, it's like spitting up and staying there and waiting for it because it will come right back at you. And so here I am But yeah, I think the experience, that first United States experience, was difficult for me, but I did learn a lot of English. You know, I graduated from Chatham High School with honors. And so I had to work really hard to even, you know, even understand. I thought I knew English until I got to Alabama. And then I was in high school, you know, hallways in the first 3 days, and the phones are going, everybody going to the classroom. And I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea what's going on.
And the accent is quite strong in Alabama, isn't it?
Oh yeah. I worked very hard not to keep it.
Yeah. No, it's great. I would never have known. And nice. If I'm not mistaken, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was around like the mid 80s where there was sort of the hyperinflation issue in Brazil, because I think the military ruling had ended. And there was a huge period of the civil government, and that led to this hyperinflation. So a lot of Brazilians were leaving at that time. But for your kind of age range around then, was it common what people did, or even having that kind of view that you did of, I want to, you know, explore abroad?
I'm not sure. I felt pretty lonely on that crusade. Brazilians are very proud, and also not very many of them were trying to even learn English to start. I think that, you know, I was privileged enough to be able to be a 10-year-old and a 15-year-old dreaming of America and, you know, and all these things. A lot of people are dreaming of the day that they can, you know, be on fifth grade and start going to make money for their family. So we're very hardworking entrepreneurs. Everybody's an entrepreneur, and you need to be able to have a network of people. So we're very proud country, and we, you know, love our country. And so I think majority of the, we have a good quality of life. Okay. Not even a rich life, but good quality, you know, like nobody's starving because we eat rice and beans. That's our staple. It's extremely cheap. Everybody eats rice and beans every day. And so we are good on that. We have family, lots of people always, you know, and like when somebody does a barbecue, everybody comes over, music is playing, and you have a little, you know, grill made of cinder blocks. And then you're like frying some chicken or whatever, and somebody comes and start playing music. And so we're happy. Mm. We're like a happy country in a way, like with ourselves, I think. Yeah, so we kind of just are content. I think a lot of people are very content.
Yeah, fascinating. And so let's move on to how you then made that eventual move.
So as I was speaking great English, and at the age of 19 years old, I created what was called the Violet Flames skateboarding events. And so long story short, you know, I tried to get me and another friend, skater friend, her name was Patricia. We tried to get money from the skateboarding companies and be like, we want to do an amateur contest and blah, blah. And they're like, girl, like, you're not even skater, man. Like, you can't get no money from us, right? So yeah. So then I was in Rio de Janeiro by that point, living there. And I went to the favelas. I don't know if you know the chant towns in Rio, you know, so the big hills. And
I went to, is it Rocinha?
Oh yeah. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's I don't know if it's the only one, but
Rocinha is one of the biggest.
It's like the travelers favelas, the one that, you know, you can actually book and do a tour there. Yeah. 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 Fascinating experience.
Yeah. So I was on Pleasure. It's called Pleasure Hill, which is a couple of hills behind Rocinha. And so I met this little kid called Tiago, and he had no shirt on, no shoes on. He grabbed my skateboard and he went down the hill and he was like, oh my God, I love this. So I created a relationship with him, and I bring pieces of skateboard if he was doing good in school and that whole story. And so I created the first volunteered, that was 1999 or 98, the first volunteer action of skateboarding in the favelas. And so I got the guns, you know, to be put down for a day, and I brought television and radio and professional skateboarders and ramps and graffiti and hip hop and all this stuff, so them to see the difference.
Amazing.
You know. Mm-hmm. So then from there, I did a couple of events for a couple of companies that are skateboarding companies in the United States, and then started translating for the World Cup of Skateboarding. And there was a contest in São Paulo, which happens used to happen every year, of the World Cup of Skateboarding. And that's how I met my ex-husband, which is a professional skateboarder. And so, you know, long story short, we fell in love and then moved to Grass Valley, California. Had my son, Julian, in Grass Valley. He was actually born 9 seconds after midnight on January 1st.
No, amazing.
First baby born in California, natural. Yeah. So he's a skateboarder and all that. Yeah, so that's how I landed back into the U.S.
And so, yeah, it seems like a story of following a, you know, I don't want to use the word love just like openly like that, but kind of a move driven by love.
Oh, 100%.
Do you think if that situation hadn't come up, you would have somehow found, do you think it was in your fate to find your way possibly to the U.S. anyway?
Yeah, I think I was starting to work already. I was already looking, you know, at 19 years old, I was already looking, you know, my thing was skateboarding, right? So I was already looking towards working with the biggest, you know, entity of skateboarding in the world, which is the World Cup of Skateboarding. Danielle Bostic and Don Bostic, I sent them a letter. I hope she still have it, actually. We sent her a letter in like 97 or 98 saying, hey, we're two girls in Brazil. We're going to start this company and we want to do amateur contests. What are the rules so our contest can count on your, you know, circuit, you know? And so I was going to go places for sure, one way or the other. I was very happy to where I was at the moment with my company and what I was doing. I was feeling very accomplished at the age of 19.
Yeah, no, that is amazing. And so arriving, if you look back to when you first got there, what would you say was the most surprising or unexpected thing when you first arrived?
Well, not surprising, but I think that the hardest thing for me was the snow. I have never seen snow in my life ever. So snow was pretty, you know, I literally didn't want to go outside. I'm like, this is too cold. Who goes outside at 24 degrees? Like, this is ridiculous. That's like the fridge, you know? So it was difficult for me. I think also, you know, I was always looking so forward and forward, and my surroundings were around me my whole life. And so when I actually, you know, took the jump and I got there, I realized that isolation was something that I never experienced before. Like I said, some people say they walk in pairs, Brazilian walk in tens, you know, like there's always a bunch of people. We're always, you know, doing things and whatever. And I started to understand like, oh, okay, America, it's a whole different way of communicating. Like, for example, like I used to, at the beginning, a girl show up and I'll go like, hey, how's it doing? You know, and kiss her. And she'll be like, oh my God. You know, it's like, oh, sorry, we kissed twice. Like there's other states that they kiss three times. At least we kiss only two. You know, we kiss everybody to start. It's a thing, you know, I don't know in the COVID days these days, but, you know, we kind of break that barrier right away at first contact in Brazil. And then, you know, I think, yeah, isolation was a thing for me. I never been treated as the immigrant before. That's another thing that was like, oh, okay, I'm not part of your tribe. I just showed up.
Yeah.
Before everybody knew me, you know, I had people knew me for 10, 20 years now, or 10, 15 years now. So I moved to the United States. I was 21 and so had my son at 22. So that was I'm still, as of today, dealing with it, I have to say.
No, it's fascinating. And yeah, you're right about the, I think it's a very, I guess just non-Western, but a culture to kind of travel in groups. And if I look at in the being from London, very international, and especially anyone that I know that's come over from, say, Spain or Italy, especially those two. And again, I'm talking just from the circle that I know, but they very much do like to whether it's because they understand the culture of the people, but stick to people from that background, or they know a lot of, you know, Italians know a lot of other Italians, even when they come here. Is it puleiros? Is that a Portuguese word for it's sticking in? I might be completely saying it wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't know. What are you trying to say?
There's a word, and I don't even know if there's an English translation, but there's a word that means either living or gathering in crowds of people. So it's like, it was referring to how a lot of immigrants, when they move abroad, they're quite content with living in one house and quite like cramped together.
Right.
But that's because economical reasons, but then also closeness as well.
That's a really great point. That is one of the reasons why my son doesn't speak Portuguese.
Okay.
And I totally get it. Like, you know, I have a lot of Guatemalan friends, El Salvador friends, Mexican friends, and they are all together. So they're like, oh, you know, I'll learn English later, because in my house, we speak my language, right? And between my people, we're speaking my language. I got dropped in Grass Valley as the only single Brazilian in who knows how far. I had no one to speak Portuguese with in front of him. So that makes a huge difference. And also I had a stepson that was 8 years old when Julian was born, Anakin. And Anakin at 8 years old was like, nope, I don't want to learn another language. You're in America, speak English.
Wow.
So like, you know, I think that by having others around you is how you can keep, you know, your nationality in a way. That's another reason why I felt so isolated, because there was no Portuguese. A lot of people were upset because I moved. I was too young. This is not going to happen, you know, whatever, right? Too dangerous. So I was pretty isolated. And so, like I say, still struggle with it today, to keep my Brazilianness. You know, it's been so... Exactly. In one more year, I will be 21 years in Brazil and 21 years in America.
Oh, wow.
Which makes me a half and half almost, right? So I have to go to Brazil at least once a year to recharge my batteries. So then I can remember where do I come from, and what I'm made of, and why sometimes I am the loudest, fastest speaking, hand moving person in the room, and I feel very sometimes inadequate because of it. But if you put 2-3 Brazilians in a room with 10 Americans, you know, the Americans are just gonna kind of like sit and watch our whole like thing, because we're so rambunctious and like, you know, we kind of take over the room. But alone, I just sound kind of strange.
Yeah.
You know, like Clubhouse, a great example. I like to say that I had to tone down my Brazilian about 75% because they can't see me. So my hands are moving, but I'm like, blah, 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 blah. People are like, oh my God, she is pissed, you know? And I'm like, I'm just trying to describe my lunch, people,
yeah.
You know? So I had to learn that just voice only, including podcasts, you know, I had to be like, okay, like, your voice is raising, like lower the voice a little, you know. So I lost my voice and myself for a good 5-6 years after. So from Grass Valley, we moved into the Big Island of Hawaii, which is like, I like to say, is the closest to Brazil I will ever get in America is in Hawaii. And so I loved it there, you know, the weather and the beach and people, everybody's half naked and everybody's like talking and there's fun going on everywhere. So I was like, oh my God, this is my place. So I loved living in Hawaii. I think in Hawaii, I kind of, my son is by then is 3-4 years old. I started to kind of flourishing. I got a best friend, Miss Tiffany Cook. And so my first American, you know, well, my second American best friend. And so I was able to be like, oh, this is who I am. And so I was able to kind of come out and remember, you know, when I got here, I was 21 years old. You know, my stepson is now 28 and I feel like he's still a kid, you know? So I was very young. So yeah, Hawaii kind of, I came out of my shell a little bit in Hawaii, which was great.
Just on that point, actually, and I don't think it's something I've ever asked before, but do you think that someone who's kind of had to go through or decided to go through this immigrant journey at a young age, it does help them to grow up a lot quicker.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, from Alabama, I was in Alabama for a year, right? And I lived in four different houses.
Wow.
Right? Because of I had black friends and the families were white, and so there's a whole thing right there. And so I learned at 16 and a half how to live alone for a year. And so when I came back home, you know, my grandmother's like, blah, blah, blah. My aunt's like, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, guess what? I'm getting a job and I'm out, you know? So at 17, I had my own house, 3-bedroom house with 2 other girls. I was working at the Levi's store in a shopping mall, and there I was, you know? So, I think that was kind of like a precursor, to where I was going. And then also, people without mothers, they grow up faster, period, you know? So I don't remember much of me being, you know, like I have my stepchild is Robin is 8 years old, just turned 8. And when I see that child wonder at the age of 8, I don't have memories of child wonder of mine ever. Mm. You know, always it was like this or that. And like, you know, I'm always like trying to fix something or getting better at something or, you know, that whole thing. So for me, it was like a life process. But I can see people that just moved to the United States and, you know, they're used to like, but this is how I like my coffee and this is how I like to do this and blah, 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 blah. And then they move and they're like, oh, boy, like, can I not get what I used to get it, you know? And who am I now?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, something that I like to explore is how people find navigating between the identity of their home country versus their new one, which you've already covered really well. And I'm wondering, for your children, do you find they have that struggle between navigating, or do they not even really have that kind of identity of Brazil?
No. So Julian... You know, I got divorced when Julian was separated, when Julian was 5 years old. So Julian will say I'm half Brazilian. Julian will say my mother, right? Because there's a bunch of like, my mom, blah, 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 right? My mom raised me to blah, 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 you know? And so with Robin, I got into Robin's life. She was just turned 5. And so she's still learning because... The Brazilian mother and American mother are 2 different mothers. Okay.
Hmm.
We're very straightforward. We're very, I talk to her and to Julian as an equal. I never baby talked. And so, you know, he's kind of part of my crew in a way. Now she's part of my crew. And I'm very like, you know, she does something wrong and I'm like, blah, 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 you know, but I don't mean it. It's because we're just loud.
Yeah.
It's just how it is, you know. And so, she's learning, you know, we have many values, Brazilian values that are instilled in Julian, like, you know, respecting your elders. And, you know, if I introduced him to, like in Brazil, you don't call someone much older than you by their first name. You call them, if you don't know them, you call them by auntie or uncle.
Yeah.
You know, Hawaii is the same way, you know, and so Julian have many aunties and uncles. So, yeah, I very much so run what I believe as my Brazilian household, for sure.
Now, it's amazing that you've said that, because that's very much instilled in our family as well, where everyone is kind of auntie and uncle as a show of respect. And I remember being younger.
Respect.
Yeah, I remember being younger, and I remember going shopping with my mum, and I can't remember where we were going, but we couldn't find parking. And so we found parking on someone's road. And then we got out and we had to walk a bit. And on the way, my mum saw someone who lived on the street. So then she just stopped him. And he happened to be from an Indian background as well, just to ask if it was okay to park here. And so she said, oh, uncle, is it okay if we park here? And I remember we walked off and I was like, mum, is that your uncle? And she's like, no. And then I was like, why did you call him uncle then? And that was the first time where, and then she explained to me that it's, you know, what we say out of respect. So it was, yeah, I just always remember that story because I was like, wow, what is the chance that my mom runs into her uncle here? And why was it such a formal conversation?
And why did I never meet him? Why have I never met him?
That's great.
Yeah.
And before moving on, one question. So say on the flip side, if an American was to move to Brazil, what would surprise them the most?
Oh, I can think of two things. One, the limited amount of personal space that he will have compared to America. And also how things in the United States work so well, right? So when you're in a third world country, no matter what, if you go to the bank and you have to do la 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 la, like things like that, and you start actually living the mundane life instead of the tourist life, you start realizing, oh, okay, I see. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, I get it. Oh, okay, my driver's license won't be ready for 6 months. Got it. You know, things like that.
Yeah. Then I'm glad I've seen the traveler side of it, because I loved it. Still one of my favorite countries that I've been to. So that's amazing. Yeah, to dive into the career side of it, and there's a lot of questions I really want to ask you about that. So yeah, let's get into that. Kind of talk me through how your career progressed.
Okay, so when I moved to San Francisco, I've been a chef, and so I moved with nothing to San Francisco. I started all over again, and so I cook Ayurvedic, which you must know, Ayurvedic food, to a 39-year-old man that had 4 herniated discs on his back. He was a millionaire. And so I cooked Ayurvedic food for him 7 days a week. Now, wow, I'm at his house for 3 hours a day cooking his food. I cook 3 meals and put them away and all that. I used to always, you know, me and my chatty self, I used to always tell him, like, you know, I used to do like skateboarding competitions and like so cool and punk rock and this and that. Anyways, long story short, I end up creating 2 30,000 people festivals in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
Within the first year and a half that I was there. The first one, the Eco Cup, was at Santa Rosa Fairgrounds, you know, because not just the hippies got to take care of the earth like everybody else does too. So I did the Eco Cup inside of the Harmony Festival, and I brought Dead Kennedys, Circle Jerks, and you know, a bunch of like punk rock bands. And then I did a mini mega ramp, which it was like 50 feet rolling into a gap of like 30 feet into the other side kind of thing. Uh-huh. And I did a professional skateboarding company with a purse of $30,000. So, you know, I did that one. And then we did City Underground, which I had, I think, 25 tattoo shops tattooing on site. And so that kind of threw me into the scene of San Francisco. Due to some, you know, personal problems, we end up closing the company. And then I went back to chefing. I chefed for another 2 or 3 years, Little Skillet, Farmer Brown, a bunch of restaurants up there. I then took Little Skillet, which is fried chicken and waffles. We became the number one food vendor at Outside Lands Festival in San Francisco, which is like 150,000 people. We were doing fresh fried chicken and waffles on site, like 30,000 pieces of chicken in a refrigerated truck, like crazy talk, really.
Yeah.
And so I did that for a couple of years. And then I started feeling like, because, you know, my career is progressing. I went, you know, line cook, sous chef, executive chef. And then I started to like, okay, where do I go now? Is it a Michelin star restaurant? Fine, you know, dining. And I was like, this kind of stuffy and I don't like it. And I really wasn't into of where the industry was going. I was jonesing for living in nature. So I moved to a little town called Garberville, California. And that is in Humboldt, which is, you know, the cannabis capital of the world. They are self-proclaimed. So then I started farming cannabis for 7 years there, and I learned regenerative practices, and I grew everything without, you know, bottles of pesticide. And so I learned how to preserve, and I learned how to, you know, kind of, I lived in a yurt that, wow, you know, ran on a generator and all those things. So I loved Humble. I became the vendor coordinator for Reggae on the River. I don't know if you ever heard. It's a really, it's not there anymore, but it's an amazing festival. Like, you know, all the Marleys, the Marley children first played was at Reggae on the River, and is literally a 10,000 people festival in the River Bar. So as the vendor coordinator, like 80 vendors, and I had to take care of their parking and their camping for 5 days. And it was a big task. And so, yeah, so then I do a lot of volunteer work, I always have done. And so I cook for volunteer events and to raise money for, you know, nonprofits and things like that. And so I cooked for the Bryceland volunteer fire department, and my husband now, Gabe, was on the board, and that's how we met. From there, you know, he is from Eastern Washington, little town called Tenasket, which is 20 miles from the Canadian border. And we came to visit. It's about 90 acres here. That's where he was born. And his father, Wayne, has been here for 20 years alone. And we kind of saw the need of care for him. Mm-hmm. And I jumped on opportunity because I wasn't able to care for my grandmother, which passed away because she was in Brazil. So I was like, oh, this is my chance to care for my elders. It's a big thing for Brazilians, is to care for your elders. And I'm sure India, right? Same thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we moved from Garberville to Tenasket, Washington. And that's where I am as of today. No good restaurant to be around, my friend. I am in the middle of nowhere. My husband's friends like to say, like, how did you get the Brazilian to the great white north? The snow is everywhere, right? And so there's a festival here called the Barter Fair, and that's been happening for 20, 30 years also. So I became the kitchen coordinator for the whole event, cooking like 3,000 meals each festival that happens twice a year. So, you know, 2018 was like, yeah, I got stuff to do. This is great. And then COVID hit and everything, community center, festival, all shut down.
Mm-hmm. So the journey that you took, firstly, it's incredible how much you did in the space of time that you did it. But also, there's a lot of what to me looks like quite big risks taken. And from the point of view of even financially, like it's some of the festivals that you set up, and then also running the restaurants that you did, and then making the move to the cannabis town. And again, they're quite big decisions where, you know, one person may only have done one of those things and been like, wow, I did took such a big risk in my life.
Right.
Where do you think that came from? Or do you think that was always in you? You know, part of me feels that that kind of mindset and ability to be like, I'm going to take risks for what I really believe or want to do. You know, once you've taken that risk of leaving a country to move abroad and kind of starting again, did that make it easier to be able to decide on these other risks?
I think so. I think that it's rooted again all the way back from being a child, you know, a motherless child. I think that every day of my entire life, I had to make those decisions and those loops and jumps. And so, but yes, I think that really moving to the United States, even if it didn't work out, and it was very difficult, you know, in a personal standpoint, I realized that if I go with what I really want, and if I listen to my internal voice, you know, that I can succeed, that I just need to listen to myself instead of the noise surrounding it. And here I am, happily married with a beautiful couple of businesses and beautiful children. And so it paid off.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I've heard that you've said, and I want to explore this a bit more. So it's a quote that you've said that, until we take regenerative and slow food practices seriously, we're all contributing to the decay of civilization.
Correct.
Is this something that has become, you know, we as a society or as a population have become notably more ignorant in recent time, or has it always been like this? Has this always been an issue?
Well, I think that about 70 years ago, industrialization started. If you look for anything behind industrialization, we were looking at the seasons. We were practicing regenerative because there was no store to go and buy a plastic bottle full of Roundup. And, you know, so I think that we, as a human, right? We were in this stage, which was before, and then industrialization was created, when it was like less quality, but faster, 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 and more, 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 more. And then we became, you know, we climbed that mountain for all those years, and then COVID hit, which is something that nobody has experienced in their lifetime. You know, for me on my side, our food system broke. Food was getting more, even more to waste. I think it's 160 million pounds of food gets wasted in the United States a week, or it's, don't quote me on that, but it's a lot. And so with COVID, restaurants shut down, the farms are not delivering, everybody's home, nobody's spending, majority of Americans don't know how to cook, they're eating out of cans and boxes of things. And so everybody was like, wait a minute, I can't go to a restaurant, somebody can't cook for me, now what? You know, and that's where for us, we became even more self-sustainable. For example, we raise a pig, and we have our chickens, we have our garden, we have, you know, so we're like, oh, okay, what don't we have? You know, and it's like, oh, we have to go to the store and we have to buy pickles. So then I started literally going around and talking with the, as soon as I moved here, really, with the whole elder community around me, you know, Gabe's aunties and uncles, and I, you know, with a little notepad and pen and being like, oh, please teach me, you know. And so I learned all these preservation methods. And so I was like, oh, we can be more self-sufficient. So I think that we were, it was going to topple anyways at some point. We just got there a little faster, right? And I think that I am part of the food revolution that's happening right now with so many amazing people. And it's happening on Clubhouse, I have to say. And so we're all trying to figure it out ways, which part is your part of the revolution, right? And so my part of the revolution, I believe the chef is the teacher of the consumer, you know, until, like, if you look on my Instagram there on Valentine's Day, I made a post and it was pears dipped in chocolate. And the, you know, the caption was, strawberries are not in season. Hello. You know, like, why are we all eating green strawberries dipped in very badly made chocolate? And you think that that proves love to someone, right? So I think the chef is that teacher. And so everything that I cook, everything that I put out, something was preserved in there. It's cooked with the seasons. And also, I think that is really important to mention that I don't think you mentioned, which is seasonal nutrition. So like a tomato in season has like three times more nutrients than a tomato in the winter, you know? So in the winter, you're supposed to be eating dark leaves and you're supposed to be eating, you know, citrus and things that are aiding your system to go through that winter.
And I think that's where kind of having this background of, say, let's say an international background, but, you know, when I've gone to Africa, when I've gone to other parts of the world where they do rely less on imports and more on domestic, they eat based on seasons more. But in, you know, growing up in London, it's only when I saw that and then came back where we can get whatever we want all year round, but that's because we just pick it up at the supermarket and it's either imported and it's really expensive now or it's full of preservatives.
Right.
That's why I wanted to ask you about, like, how do you see this getting better? Or I know you say there's revolution, but is it slow and strenuous, or do you see some significant progress in this area?
Well, we have to look back and, you know, we are in a generation that wants things fast, right? Like if you click a button and it takes 3 seconds, you feel like it was an eternity, right? So you got to think about, it took 70 years to get where we are today. Hopefully it doesn't, you know, we have so many other tools. It won't take us 70 years to get to where we need to get, because I don't think we have that time. But I think that the next 5 to 10 years are going to really change the way we view and see food.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. I hope so. And it's amazing that you found such a strong cohort. And like you said, you know, Clubhouse is great for that, that you found these people who are committed to that same cause, which is amazing. And
yes,
now I understand you're the business development manager for Food Bay TV. I looked into this before and I have a personal sentiment for it because both my parents are born in Africa. And so, you know, growing up, I went to Kenya, and 3 years ago, I went back to Uganda to see where my dad grew up. So I have a very close affinity to that continent as it is. But even from an objective point of view, it sounds like a really excellent initiative. I would love for you to quickly tell the listeners what it's about, but then also I'd love to know where your particular passion to get involved in this came from.
Yes. Okay. So Foodbay TV is a 24-hour healthy lifestyle and food network based in Nigeria. I met the CEO on Clubhouse. And so we kind of went on a rampage of a couple of days of talking 4 or 5 hours a day. And I have a deep passion for Africa. When I was 9 years old, we took a trip by car from Curitiba all the way to the top of Brazil, which took us like a week. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, the mini Africa is up there. And I got to eat the food and experience the music. And I was just like, oh my God. And so I've been in love with it ever since. And also the idea that is a healthy lifestyle and food network. That's where he hooked me in. So yeah, as the North and South America Business Development Manager, my job is to, first and foremost, I'm going to Africa in May 18 to June 22nd for a little over a month, to Nigeria, Ghana, and Kenya. And I'm going to film, they created a program just for me called Food Source, where I would be, you know, beginning of the episode, I'll be eating at a restaurant or a street food place, and eating a plate that has fish, for example. And then I'm traveling all the way to the fish markets where that fish comes from. So that's why I be called Food Source. And so when I come back validated, because I've been there, I've done it, then I'm going to start looking for American dollars and American sponsors. So then we can start creating content from the diaspora here and sending it into the network. The two goals, which are huge goals, 10 years, 5 years goals. One is to highlight and bring the African food into the world plate. And two is to facilitate food tourism in Africa. So, and I love both things. I think it's a great mission. There are amazing people. And so, yeah, so then I'm gonna, you know, hopefully be filming programs here in the United States and hopefully the world of the diaspora to send to Food Bay TV. So someday the food, you know, people say, oh, you know, us of color, BIPOC, you know, we can't wait to sit at that table, you know, and Food Bay TV is saying, let's just build the table. And then you always have a seat on it, you know? So that's what we're doing, which is, I think it's extremely important. I'm also, because I feel the weight of the world on me on this trip. I feel like I want to bring the most value and do the most that I can. So I am mentoring a girl named Faith. She just started her little healthy sandwich delivery into the university that she goes into. She is on her fourth year of crop science. She's going to be a scientist. And so she's amazing. So I help her with, you know, business plans and all these things. So I'm trying to, you know, hook up with organizations that, you know, help women farmers and women empowerment and regenerative practices. You know, I want to be able to help and teach or, you know, experience the continent as best as I can.
Yeah, it's amazing what you're doing there. And I think it ties back to the beginning of, you know, realizing that you've always had this innate desire, whether it's through your upbringing to help. It really ties into the fact that you found something you're so passionate about that gives you that platform to be helping on potentially such a huge scale.
Right.
So, yeah, it's such an amazing thing. And like I say, because of my kind of connection to Africa, and African food is great. They have some very good vegan options as well. So amazing. Yeah. And you've also started up a podcast.
Yes.
Called Craft Food Podcast.
Yep. Craft Food Podcast.
I obviously love podcasts myself. On a recent episode, I was speaking with someone about how the medium of podcast provides so much value and education to the listeners, but there's also such an important value for the host and the speaker to be able to have this medium almost sometimes just to get stuff off their chest, but know that there is an audience out there that could benefit from what they're sharing. So What was your intention behind creating this?
Yeah, so Craft Food Podcast, right? It's a place for me where we could talk about the revolution of food on my within my scope and with the people I believe are important. I bring a monthly dose of information, inspiration, just to create change in the way that we see our food. You know, we talk about when life was like simpler, you know, food didn't travel 3,000 miles to get to your mouth. You know, also like the impact that feeding ourselves have in the world and our relationship with food, eating with the seasons can change the landscape of food and as we see it, you know, so it's a revolution. I talk a lot of, you know, it's an array of topics like food preservation, farm to table concepts, organic certification, regenerative farming, and like so much more. I can talk forever about it, but we're not on my podcast now, RV.
Well, yeah, for anyone who is interested in that, then Craft Food Podcast, I'll be tuning in. And especially after this conversation, it gives me so much more context of what to look out for. So it's amazing. When I was living in China, there was one project that was being run by this person that I knew. The purpose of it was focused on the supply chain, and he was focused on being able to do that kind of farm-to-table tracking of food supplies. And you know, there's the whole thing of it's so easy to say it's come from XYZ, whereas it hasn't. Whereas his whole point of creating this blockchain platform was to be like, this is a unamendable or unchangeable document of the actual journey. So if someone really wanted to know in a restaurant or somewhere where this came from, they would be able to track the whole transaction all the way back. So
it's funny you say that, because I'm working with this amazing woman called Genevieve Lavelle, and she is the CEO of AgriLedger. You should research that. And it's an untokenized blockchain auditing system that she's trying to literally bypass FDA and USDA and create a whole new system where the middleman no longer exists. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, amazing stuff happening.
It's
fascinating. So yeah, I mean, thank you for sharing all that. It's exceeded my expectation in the insights that I gained from what you're working on. So I really, really appreciate that you've decided to share all that and even some of the more vulnerable points in your life. And so what I like to do is end with what I call a quick fire five. So are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, so to start the quick fire five, the question one, what is the most valuable lesson you learned growing up?
The most valuable lesson I think I learned growing up is that resilience is the essence of life.
Succinct, yes. I love that. And number two, when you left Brazil, if you could have moved to anywhere else in the world, where would you have gone?
You know, I was thinking about that, and I just always knew I was going to end up in the U.S. But I think back then, if I could have thought of somewhere, maybe I would have thought of Hawaii to start, because I believe Hawaii is its own country.
Yeah, fair enough. It's a place that when I went traveling, I met someone from Hawaii. It was one of those where he said, come and visit. And I was like, yeah, sure. And that's probably 8 years ago now. So it's still on the list.
Oh, you need to go.
I'll try and get hold of it. Maybe he's still there. And number three, what book title would you give to your autobiography?
Okay, so I would call it Head Above Water, A Tale of Resilience.
I'd read that. Yeah, I'd read that for sure.
I'm actually writing it, so it's cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go then. Yeah. Yeah, let me know when that's done.
Yep.
And it's cool because I feel like this podcast has given people like sneak peeks of what would be in there. So it's almost like a promo into your life. Excellent. And number four, if you could give one lesson to the future leaders of Africa, what would that be?
The welfare of your people is the welfare of your continent. And to incentivize product development in Africa, because Africa is kind of known forever where you just go to, you take an ingredient, you pay barely nothing, and then you make hundreds of dollars when you go somewhere else. So if Africans, you know, the whole continent starts to create the product, you know, with those ingredients, we can keep the money more into the continent than moving it into somewhere else.
Yeah, that is amazing. I couldn't agree more. It's something that my dad's told me a lot about. And in season one of this podcast, which goes through my kind of family journey, that gets covered And I think you phrased it so well. It's such a resourceful continent, but all it's ever done is people taking and leaving with it without contributing back into it.
Yeah,
I couldn't have said it any better myself, what you said. Let's hope someone's listening. Number five, if you could ask Robin and Julian for one favor of how you'd like them to carry on your legacy, what would it be?
Okay, I couldn't set on one. So to pay attention on what enters on your body, to read labels, respect your elders and learn from them, and to always keep your word.
Yeah, I don't even think that should be a favor just for them two. I think it should be a favor for all the children of the future. So
right.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are the five. And I've made the mistake before of saying that people can, they don't have to make it quick fire, but then it turns into a whole other interview. So I love how you phrased those. And a bonus question that I like to ask everyone, and it's based on an inspiration I took from something called the Six Words Memoirs. But if you could describe your life journey in roughly a 6-word sentence, what would it be?
Okay, I came up with 7. So my resilience is the essence of my power.
Oh, that's good. I should start writing these down. Yeah, I'm going to write that down. Awesome. Well, yeah, thank you again so much. That comes to an awesome conclusion of this episode. And it truly has been more than I expected. So thank you.
Yes, thank you, Anand. I love talking to you. It was so easy. It's like, you know, we're just having a conversation by the poolside. So yeah. I love it. Thank you so much. It's a very important platform. And what you're doing is very important. To give voice to the immigrant is a very important thing. Because if you look back, we're all an immigrant one way or the other.
What's going on, guys? Thank you for tuning in, and I really hope I fulfilled my promise that this really was going to be a great episode. Make sure to share the key messages and quotes that you learn on Instagram and tag The Journey Onwards. As always, you can reach out to either me or Michelle on anything that was discussed in today's episode, and our contact details will be in the show notes. If you want to be a guest or know anyone who would fit perfectly onto this, please drop me a message and I will get back to you. As always, I love it every time you're here, and I'm back every Tuesday with an incredible guest. So have a great week and keep adding greatness to your own journey.